This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The White Fleet, Blood on the Stars, Book 7, written by Jay Allen, performed by Jeffrey Kafer.
Chapter 1. Fleet Control Center. CFS Dauntless. Year 315 AC. The command center was massive, a gleaming open room filled with more than 40 workstations, each with a plush black chair positioned behind it. The stations were arranged in circular groupings, each designed to house a specific team. Navigation, helm, communications, tactical, fleet control, operations. And in the center on a small raised platform was the admiral's chair. It was almost grotesque in its grandiosity, at least to Baron's eyes. To the left sat the flag captain, the officer in actual command of the vessel, and to the right the fleet commander's senior aide. The size of the room was nothing compared to the enormous ship that housed it, over 5.5 million tons and bristling with weapons. She was the pinnacle of the Confederation's power, the greatest war machine that nation had ever produced, larger and stronger than anything its neighbors could field. Baron was still in awe, still processing the ship's immense capabilities, almost a year and a half after he'd first set eyes on her out at Station Grimaldi. She'd been nearly finished then, but not quite. She was called Dauntless. The name had been official now for nearly 6 months, ever since the day Baron himself had led the christening ceremony. He'd been surrounded by all the survivors of his old crew, and a crowd of fawning dignitaries the likes of which he had never before seen. He'd spoken the words, bestowed the name on the vast and amazing construct with all the enthusiasm he could muster, but his heart just hadn't been in it. It had been a difficult day, one he still remembered with some discomfort. Van Stryker and Gary Holston had meant well, and Baron was fully aware that they'd been driven only by a true and deep respect for him and for the last ship to have carried the name. But Baron still felt a bit disloyal, calling another ship Dauntless. It had bothered him then, and it still did even now, just days before the great ship was set to officially enter service, and with him in that monstrous admiral's chair to lead a great fleet deep into the unknown. Baron fully supported the White Fleet's mission. Twice in the last war, the Confederation had faced the specter of defeat at the hands of an enemy armed with ancient technology. Exploration for and use of such artifacts was strictly regulated by international treaty. But Baron sometimes thought the Confederation was the only nation that burdened itself with compliance to what had to be the most ignored document in diplomatic history. Certainly the Union, not to mention the vast network of smugglers and adventurers on the Confederation's Badlands border, plied a healthy trade in bits and pieces of the amazing technology that mankind had lost to the cataclysm so long ago. The trade in ancient tech, such as it existed, was confined to black markets and obscured by shrouds of secrecy. It had operated for at least a century, various scraps of ancient devices selling for enormous prices, all tremendously useful technology, but rarely enough to upset the balance of power. Until recently, the discoveries made during the last conflict, the planet killer and the pulsar, even the stealth generator Baron had used, had threatened to upend the entire international order. Any nation that was able to secure and deploy a weapon of such magnitude would become massively more powerful than its neighbors, with consequences that could only be imagined. "She's a beauty, isn't she?" Baron allowed himself a little smile, half forced, half genuine, but he didn't turn around. Not yet. He hadn't heard Van Stryker coming onto the bridge, but he recognized his voice immediately. "She is that, sir," he said, trying, not entirely successfully, to keep the doubt from his tone. "But she's not Dauntless, is she? Not really." Baron did turn now, his eyes finding Stryker's. "She's an amazing ship, sir. There's nothing else like her." It wasn't an answer to the admiral's question. Baron didn't want to admit just how much he ached for his old vessel. It had been more than a year and a half, and he was becoming a bit embarrassed about how frequently his lost ship remained in his thoughts. "You can talk to me, Ty. I've been there. We all remember our first commands, but Dauntless was something truly special, wasn't she? The two of you saved the Confederation more than once. At least that's how I see it. Whatever happens, your first Dauntless is immortal. She will live forever in the history texts. But your career isn't finished yet, my friend, not by a long shot. The war may be over, but the danger is still there. You know that as well as I do. It's time to go on, Ty. Time to start a new chapter. You didn't die on Dauntless, and you can't keep on acting like you did. There's too much ahead of you. Of course, Admiral. I'm fine. And I'm ready. Truth be told, Baron didn't want to go at all. He liked the new Dauntless well enough, and he'd even managed to think of the battleship as the rightful successor to the sacrificed original. He had almost all of his original crew under his new command, somewhere in the fleet if not on the flagship itself, and he believed completely in the mission. But his heart just wasn't in making such a long journey. He wasn't sure if it was still fatigue from the war, if he'd simply watched too many of his people die, or if he'd exhausted his ability to face endless crises. But deep down he wished he could stay. He tried to fight it, to embrace the mission. It was an extraordinary chance to explore deep into the unknown, into mankind's mysterious and tragic past. It was something that would have filled his younger self with almost boundless excitement. But the old spirit just wasn't there anymore. I wouldn't have asked you to go, Ty, but there's no one else who could take your place. The cream of the Navy is serving with the White Fleet, volunteers all, mostly because they wanted to serve under you. Stryker hesitated and then continued slowly. You're the Navy's hero now, Ty, as much as your grandfather was in his day. I know that's uncomfortable for you, but it's well-deserved. And you'll have to learn to embrace it, because it's not going anywhere. Baron just nodded. He would admit he'd done his duty, perhaps even a bit more. He was gratified that he'd served as he had, and he allowed himself to imagine that his famous grandfather would have been proud of him. But the public adoration grated on his nerves. He constantly tried to direct some of the praise streaming his way toward Atara Travis and Anya Fritz, Jake Stockton, Sarah Eaton, dozens of others who'd fought and served, and no small number who died. All to no avail. The public had made him the symbol of the Navy's victory, and he'd had almost no success in deflecting or evading it. But there was no victory. The Senate threw away the victory. We survived the fight, that's all. And we left the conflict unresolved, condemning another generation to war and death because we lacked the resolve to do what had to be done. Perhaps it will be good to get away for a while, sir. It was somewhat of a tangential response, but as he said the words, he realized he truly meant what he had said. He didn't want to go. Not really. But there was one unmistakable benefit of leaving. He'd be away for months, perhaps a year or more, away from the interview requests, the parades, the fawning local dignitaries who plagued him everywhere he went. He thought about it all for a few seconds, feeling a touch of excitement build about the impending departure. But then he stopped. A somber look slipping back on his face. He would be away from Andy, too. He was hard-pressed to categorize his relationship with the now-retired adventurer. She had the ability to frustrate him like no one else he knew, and she was as pig-headedly stubborn as, well, as he was. She'd also claimed a place like no one else ever had, in his thoughts and in his life, and he hadn't been able to dislodge her from either. He'd even realized somewhere along the line he didn't want to. He knew he could never escape the Navy. It was an obligation into which he'd been born, and one that his exploits in the war had only made stronger and more demanding. And it complicated any relationships he might have, especially one with her. Andy LaFarge was a lot of things, but no part of her resembled the dutiful spouse of a career flag officer. And Baron knew, as well as he knew anything, that any attempt she might make to pretend that wasn't the case was doomed to failure. Nevertheless, he loved her. He'd finally admitted that to himself, and he knew she returned the feeling. But for two people like them, their lives fixed on such diverse trajectories, that just wasn't enough. The most they could hope for was a collection of fleeting moments together. His had been an arranged marriage, to the Navy itself, and in the end he'd remained faithful. I think you'll feel better once you set out. You'll leave behind all the cameras and the reporters. Stryker's words pulled Baron from his thoughts, at least partially. They'll probably all come after me when they can't get to you. The Admiral grinned. Baron returned the smile robotically, but his thoughts were still mostly on Andy. He'd remained at the front for almost 6 months after the destruction of the Pulsar, as the temporary ceasefire gradually gave way to a semi-permanent truce, and ultimately a full-fledged peace treaty. He'd been against the whole thing, absolutely convinced that after four wars, the Confederation should invade the prostrate Union and make damn sure there was never a fifth conflict. But it quickly became clear that the Confederation's population was tired of war. They would never support an offensive of that magnitude, even one history seemed to justify so clearly. He'd got an extended leave after the final peace was signed, and he spent almost all of it with Andy. She'd settled on Tellurus, one of the wealthiest worlds in the Confederation, a playground for the rich and pampered. She had bought an immense villa overlooking one of the planet's pristine inland seas, and they'd spent nearly six blissful months there, before duty called again and pulled him back to his real life. He missed her now, but he was also worried about her. Andy Lafarge had come from grinding poverty so intense, few who hadn't experienced such deprivation could imagine it. She'd been driven since childhood, not just to pull herself up from the bottom, but to gain the vast wealth she'd seen as a child, watching the industrial barons and merchant princes living lives almost beyond the imagination of an orphan street urchin. She'd attained that, and more. The stealth generator had been a find of epic proportions, and Gary Holston had paid her a vast fortune for it. Now she spent her days walking around a magnificent villa, almost a palace, her ship Pegasus stored in space dock, and her crew scattered across the Confederation, spending their own considerable wealth. She'd been happy during the time they'd been together, he was sure of that. But he still remembered the look in her eyes when he said goodbye. She'd been sorry to see him go, of course, but he'd seen something more there. She seemed lost. Baron had never met anyone as determined and strong-willed as Andy. She'd achieved her lifelong goal, but now he wondered if she would find contentment in retirement, or if the inaction would wear her down. Those concerns had been there since he'd parted with her, but now on the verge of beginning a bold new adventure of his own, he wondered if she would find satisfaction in her newfound wealth and luxury, or if she would wither away in her gilded palace. "I see you're already gone." Stryker's tone was genial, amused, but Baron realized the Admiral had been talking for some time and he hadn't heard a word of it. "I'm sorry, sir, I've just got things on my mind." "Should be fine, Ty. It will take more than a couple billion credits to take down Andy Lafarge." Baron felt a wave of surprise that the Admiral knew what he'd been thinking about. Then he realized he shouldn't have. He and Andy had been about the last two people in the fleet to recognize the obviousness of the connection they shared. Baron almost denied he'd been thinking about Andy, but then he just gave in. "I know she will, sir. It's just that, well, I'll be gone for so long, and she..." He let his voice trail off. He didn't know what to say. He didn't have any specifics, just a feeling that boredom would drive her crazy, no matter how opulent her surroundings. Stryker didn't say anything else, and neither did Baron. They just stood in the command center for a long time, silent. Then they turned and headed toward the shuttle bay for one more trip down to Megara's surface before the fleet departed. One more damned parade to attend. Chapter 2 People's New Service Announcement.
"Workers of Liberté City, rejoice. This morning, seven traitors met final justice in the Place de Révolution on the orders of Citizen Villeneuve. These men and women betrayed their fellow workers and conspired with fugitives from the old government to destroy the ideals of the revolution. Death to all who conspire against the revolution. Long live the People's Union."
All of the people. Liberté City. Planet Montmorau, Gassara 4. Unioneer 219. 315 AC.
"I understand your reluctance, Ricard, but I need your help. We have done far better than we could have dared to imagine over the last year and a half, but the situation is still fragile. We cannot take any chances, and I need someone extremely capable and who I can trust in charge of the PP. I'm afraid that pretty much nails it down to you."
"Gaston, it's not that I don't want to help, but administration is not my strength. You know this. You, better than anyone, are aware just where my true skills lie."
Ricard Lié sat on the hard, uncomfortable chair, looking across the cheap, mass-produced metal desk at Gaston Villeneuve. The room had nothing of the obscene luxury that had been so prevalent in Villeneuve's old office. It reeked of the workplace of a man of the people, one concerned only with the good of society, utterly unconcerned with wealth and the trappings of power. Incorruptible. It was all a sham, every creaky, rusted millimeter of it. Lié stifled a smile. The past 18 months had confirmed the gullibility of the people, if nothing else. Gaston Villeneuve was a capable man, but his new image as the champion of the masses was a fiction, far removed from the motivation that actually drove him. Notwithstanding the grubby office and the factory worker's garb he'd taken to wearing in public. Lié had hoped the assassination of the entire Presidium would allow Villeneuve to escape the retribution of his political rivals, to buy time to figure a way to prevent or survive the Union's collapse. But he hadn't for an instant imagined how far his ally might press his advantage. Gaston Villeneuve had been a member of the now despised Presidium himself. Worse, he'd been the head of the dreaded Sector 9, the feared intelligence agency. Yet he'd somehow survived the downfall of the Union, survived and come out on the other side as the reborn nation's sole and uncontested ruler, his power vastly more complete and absolute than it had been. There may be truth to what you say, but you can be trusted, Ricard, and that is true of very few people. You are one of the smartest men I have ever known. I'd love nothing more than to keep you in the shadows, ready to perform your special skills when needed. But there's no one else I can rely upon. Not now. Not at this critical stage. I can't trust ZPP to someone who might make a move against me. Not until I've secured a far firmer grip on things. Lié still wasn't sure how his comrade had managed to achieve all he had, save for the fact that he'd surfed a wave of blood into the top position. Villeneuve had scapegoated everyone he'd considered a danger to his own power, as well as any members of the old government who'd been too well known, too associated with the repressive past. The executions had gone on for months, retainers and lower-level allies of the murdered Presidium members, government officials, families of the condemned, even enough operatives from the old Sector 9, his own former agents, to sate the public's hatred. After the bloodletting, Villeneuve shifted a cadre of surviving agents, those whose identities had been sufficiently discreet, and recreated the discredited spy agency under the amusing title of the People's Protectorate. Now he wanted Lié to take charge, to step into the very same position Villeneuve himself had held before. Lié still wanted to refuse, but he knew he couldn't. He and Villeneuve were friends of a sort, but he was well aware that refusing his ally's request could be dangerous. Villeneuve had eliminated almost all his enemies, and he controlled every tentacle of the government. More amazingly, he'd somehow managed to win over the mob. His requests carried the force of irresistible commands, and refusing him would be unwise in the extreme. Besides, Lié's own fortunes were closely tied to Villeneuve's. If an operative in charge of the reconstituted spy agency, one with his own ambitions, tried to move against Villeneuve, it would be as dire a threat to Lié as to his friend. Lié had no doubts, none at all, that anyone who overthrew Gaston Villeneuve would come for him next. "Very well, Gaston, but only because you need me." Villeneuve nodded. "I knew I could count on you. ZPP is not yet up to Sector 9's operational standouts, but we must be cautious. We cannot rush recruiting. We must maintain the tightest possible control over our security, and particularly the new section heads." Lié knew Villeneuve had kept a tight grip on Sector 9, but he was just as aware there had always been a fair amount of scheming among the ambitious senior operatives. It seemed his friend was determined to take advantage of the situation to eliminate such problems from the start. Lié doubted that was possible. He had too dark a view of human nature to imagine anything but a swamp of betrayal and corruption surrounding him. But a fresh start would certainly delay the development of conspiracies and plots within the agency. Eliminating such problems, even for a short time, would allow the new regime to cement its position. "Do I have authority to handle anyone I view as a potential problem?" Lié knew his friend was very aware of how he would handle something like that. "Yes." It was a simple answer, more direct and unconditional than Lié had expected. Villeneuve really did trust him. The two men were silent for a few seconds. Then Lié asked, "What are your top priorities? The People's Protectorate does not yet have the resources Sector 9 enjoyed. We will have to be careful where we deploy our limited assets."
The workers' councils, of course. We need to continue to cement our control over them.
The workers' councils had been Lié's idea, but Villeneuve had taken it further even than his friend had imagined possible. He'd met with them, at least those in the major cities on Montmorel, and he'd passed emergency decrees giving them extraordinary powers to revamp work rules and mete out punishments to former managers, those accused, and nothing more than accusation was necessary, of abuses against the workers under the old regime.
That is relatively easy on a case-by-case basis, but we're talking about thousands of individual councils, Gaston. No matter what we do, it's going to take time to get to them all.
Lié was continually amazed at how little it took to entice so many to betray their comrades and their loudly stated ideals. The efforts to infiltrate the councils had begun with nothing more than extra rations, before progressing to bequests of a more substantive type, such as the homes of former government commissars and promises of political power. A few men and women had refused such advances, but there were so few it had been easy enough to do away with them. Some had been killed outright, feigned accidents and the like, but most had simply been denounced to the others as traitors. It was easy enough to create fake trails of payoffs and falsified communications, and the workers, still charged with revolutionary zeal, spend little time analyzing the accuracy of evidence before casting their comrades to the rage of the mob.
I trust you to prioritize the various worlds. Production centers and resource-rich planets first, of course, as well as strategically located systems.
Understood, Lié nodded. But it will take time.
Villeneuve nodded before continuing. Baru is still a problem, of course, though I don't think there's a solution until we can concentrate enough military powers there to crush the traitors. Still, I don't like the reports I've been getting. My gut tells me Confederation intelligence has been assisting the rebels. We can't allow the situation there to get any worse. I'd like you to try to get some intelligence assets on the ground there, at least enough to get a lead on the Confed's involvement. We'll never retake the planet without a full-scale attack, but I need you at least to try and interdict Confederation interference.
I'll do everything I can there. Lié paused. But I suggest you also submit a formal complaint to the Confederation Senate. There's no question Gary Holston doesn't trust us, but whatever he's doing on Baru, it's pretty likely he doesn't have Senate approval. If you can get the Confed politicians on his back, it will do more to slow his efforts than anything sect PP agents can achieve, at least in the near term.
That's a great idea. At the speeds they've been demobilizing their military, the last thing they want is an incident that might provoke renewed hostilities.
Villeneuve frowned.
Not that we're in any position to start a new fight ourselves, but that doesn't stop us from expressing our outrage at this blatant violation of the peace terms.
Lié nodded in agreement. Then he asked, Any other top priorities?
Yes, one. Villeneuve sighed. You're aware that the Confederation is sending a fleet to explore deep into the Badlands?
Yes, I'd heard a few reports about that. It's true, then?
I'm afraid so.
Villeneuve was silent for a moment.
You know as well as I do how vital old tech is going to be going forward.
His voice tightened, suppressed anger clearly trying to surface.
Tyler Baron and his people caused us victory twice by destroying artifacts we discovered.
Ricard looked quizzically over to Villeneuve.
I agree with the threat the Confederation's expedition presents, but I'm not sure what I can do to lessen that.
Nothing, at least not regarding the Confederation's exploration fleet. But there are other sources of old tech. Sector 9 always had an extensive intelligence presence along the Confederation's border with the Badlands. It was very productive, and I want it re-established immediately.
That was a pretty expensive operation, Gaston. Bribing frontier prospectors and the like. Are you sure we can spare that much currency?
We don't have a choice. We have no hope of mounting the kind of force the Confeds are sending out, so we've got to make do with the closer inworlds. There are still plenty of crews working the border, more than before, now that the war's over and the frontier bars are flooded with discharged spacers looking for new careers. And don't forget, what they do is still illegal in the Confederation. We need to be in this game, Ricard, any way we can.
Rebuilding the Union, the People's Union, is one thing. But we're going to need more tech, too, or we'll be left behind. Lee nodded.
I understand. And I agree completely. As soon as I get the other operations underway, I may even go to the Confederation frontier myself. We've got less to work with now, and that means we've got to get more from what we can deploy.
Do that. I'll miss having you here, but I feel a hell of a lot better knowing you're there. We also need to rebuild our operative network in the Confederation, and the frontier is as good a place to start as any. We need to know if they find anything new.
Understood.
Leia looked down for a few seconds, amused and mildly depressed as well, at the discolored gray metal of the desk where the effective dictator of the Union, or the roughly 80% of it over which he'd managed to retain or regain control at least, worked every day. It was a far cry from the priceless antiques that had filled Villeneuve's previous office. Leia understood the reasoning, and he couldn't argue with the massive success his friend had achieved through his play-acting. But part of him missed the days of more open luxury, at least for those in power. He didn't doubt Villeneuve lived in the same obscene decadence he had before, but now that kind of thing took place strictly behind closed doors.
Well, Lee looked up, re-establishing eye contact. It will take me several weeks to get the operation started that will cement our control over the workers' councils.
He paused. We've picked low-hanging fruit so far, the councils close to home, the ones we could focus on ourselves. You know there's going to be slippage, foul-ups, especially on the planets farther out. I will set for specific operating criteria, but some agents will screw up, others will run into particularly troublesome councils.
He hesitated.
At some point we are going to have to go back and clean up the problems. Random disappearances and scripted denouncements are useful, but eventually we're just going to have to send in the Feu de Rouge, or whatever we're calling them now.
The People's Army, you mean?
Villeneuve's eyes were locked on Lee's, and the expression on his face was deadly serious.
And yes, they will undoubtedly be needed to execute the final stage of the operation, but the more we can handle with clandestine means, the better off we will be. We've done what we had to do, my friend, to survive and to exploit the situation. It will take time to establish the level of control we need, to rebuild our forces and infiltrate every important group, to establish enhanced surveillance and throw the workers back in their place. But we will get there.
There was a silence in the room that seemed to bring the temperature down several degrees.
When we do recount, these people, these workers, will learn to appreciate whatever we choose to give them, and they will come to understand real fear.
Chapter 3. Troyes City. Planet Megara, Oleus 3. Year 315 AC.
Ty, I don't have to tell you how important this mission is. You know that, probably better than anyone.
Admiral Van Stryker sat at the conference table, his eyes darting back and forth between Baron and Gary Holston. The head of Confederation Intelligence had been uncharacteristically quiet, mostly watching as Stryker and Baron discussed the mission. He was deep in thought, concerned about sending Tyler Baron and thousands of spacers so deep into the unknown. He'd been a part of the decision-making apparatus that had sent men and women to war often enough into battles that had killed legions of them. But there was something different about this. Baron and his people would be the first Confederation spacers to journey so far from home, and in a way back in time as well, as they ventured deep into the heart of the dead ancient empire.
No, sir, you don't.
Baron sat upright, looking a little stiff. Not exactly nervous, but a bit agitated, perhaps. The last war made it pretty clear that the next one won't be won by heroics or economic might. There's too much technology out there left over from the past, and if the Pulsar taught us anything, it's what kind of difference even a single artifact can make.
You know better than anyone what a close thing that was. If you had managed to destroy the thing, who knows what might have happened. Feu de Rouge could be marching on Megara even now.
Stryker leaned back and took a deep breath.
We're very restricted by the treaties governing old tech, Tyler, but even if we have to share any finds with the other powers, it's better than risking someone else discovering something like the Pulsar, someone a little less dedicated to treaty obligations.
Stryker's tone left little doubt he thought the whole notion of sharing artifacts was ridiculous, and that if it had been up to him, he'd have told Baron to hide anything his expedition found. "Tyler," Holston finally spoke. He'd had something he wanted to say since they'd all sat down together, one last meeting before the fleet set out. But it wasn't based on hard data or intel, only on a feeling that had plagued his gut. "I would tell you to be careful out there, but I know that's not necessary. Still..." He paused, his edginess as clear he suspected to his two companions as it was to himself. "It's just that we like to think of ourselves, this small cluster of habitation so close to the rim, as all that is left of humanity after the cataclysm." "Are you suggesting there are others?" Stryker sounded surprised. "We've never had any indications of any other survivors." Holston took a deep breath and exhaled. "And we've never gone as far as we're about to, either." He paused. "I'm just saying we really don't know what's out there, or even how vast the Empire was, how many hundreds, thousands of systems are connected by warp points, how far that web stretches. We've never had any real data on what lies out beyond the limited range that's been explored. Even the hardiest frontier smugglers have stayed fairly close to the border, 10, maybe even 20 transits. What if the transwarp network goes on for scores of systems, hundreds, thousands? How could we possibly even guess at what's out there?" The three men were silent for a moment. Finally, Baron said, "Well, I guess that's one reason we're going, to find out. I'm more concerned right now with locating refinable fuel sources than I am with stumbling on ghosts of the old Empire. But I can promise both of you we'll keep our eyes open for anything that might be out there." "Do that, Ty. In the war, at least you knew when you were heading into danger. This time you've got no idea what to expect. Once you get past the close-in Badlands, every jump will be into the unknown. What records we've got of Imperial times are so incomplete, they're almost useless. Trust your gut, and remember, you have the authority to end the mission and return at any time. If you run into danger, no matter what it is, come home." Holston wasn't used to feeling as uneasy as he did. He'd been the leading proponent of the mission, but he'd become increasingly nervous as time passed and the departure date approached. He had no idea what Baron and his fleet would find. None at all. There was no useful intelligence, no real data of any kind. He didn't like shooting blind, and he'd come to realize that if he could go back a year and a half to when he'd first been one of the plan's enthusiastic proponents, he might pull his support. He didn't have any new knowledge, no more reason to fear what might happen than he had back on Grimaldi. But the ache in his gut had gotten steadily worse. "I'll be careful, Gary. Don't worry about that. This is just an exploration mission, and as creepy as plunging through dead and haunted systems might be, if I get the slightest idea that something's wrong, I'll be back here in a flash." Holston didn't believe that. Baron's career hadn't exactly been a demonstration in shying away from danger. But there was nothing he could do about it, not now. It was far too late to cancel the expedition. And the original impetus, the need to get as much old tech as possible, was as valid as ever. Nothing to do but wish Baron the best of luck and shake his hand. And he did just that. "Welcome, Commander Globus. I am honored by your presence. I didn't expect an officer of such rank and experience to command the Alliance contingent." The Palatians had sent a small flotilla, 3 battleships and 6 escorts. Their contribution was more about inclusion and helping to sustain and develop the Confederation-Alliance relationship than it was about providing needed strength and power to the fleet. Still, after watching Jovi Gracchus and her pilots out at the bottleneck, Baron knew he would never take any number of Palatian warriors on his side for granted. "The honor is mine, Admiral Baron. Your name is as well known in the Alliance as in the Confederation, and nearly as revered, I dare say." Baron suspected there was some diplomatic nicety in Globus's statement. Baron had aided Tarkus Venius and the Grey Alliance during the Civil War, and the current Imperator, Vian Tullus, was a man Baron included on the small list of men and women he called true friends. But he'd first encountered the Alliance as an enemy, the man who had destroyed Invictus and killed Katrine Regellis and her crew. It had been less than 3 years since he'd led the assault that crushed Palatia's orbital defenses and laid the planet open to invasion. That had been done in the service of Venius and the Grey Alliance forces, but Baron knew enough about Palatian martial pride to understand that had to be a cause of resentment among some officers. It didn't require looking any farther than the vengeful rage that had driven Jovi Gracchus for so long to understand the mixed feelings many in the Alliance no doubt had toward him. Your words do me great honor, Commander. I trust you are aware how sincerely the Confederation values its friendship with your people. Baron countered Globus's diplomacy with a touch of his own. Most of the Navy appreciated the Alliance and the aid that power had provided in the closing stages of the war. The Alliance contingent had fought like wildcats, and though the destruction of the Pulsar had been the climactic act of the struggle, the Palatians played no small part in the overall battle. Still, to many in the Confederation, the Alliance seemed odd, their warrior culture a little too foreign for the average citizen to fully understand. And as a power that lay out beyond what most in the Confederation considered the Rim, many thought the Alliance was provincial. "So, we have both played the parts assigned to us, Admiral," the Palatian smiled. "Perhaps we can go somewhere now and talk a bit more informally. The Imperator gave me some messages for you, words he tasked me to deliver privately." A short pause. "And he sent several cases of wine as well, the very best from the Tullus Vineyards." Baron returned the smile. He wasn't much of a drinker, but he wasn't about to refuse Globus's hospitality, nor that of Vian Tullus. It would be unacceptable to be ungracious to the Alliance's Imperator, or to a friend with whom he'd shed blood. And Tullus was both. Besides, it was a good chance to get to know Globus a bit better. The two had met briefly during the Civil War, but now it was time to build a true relationship. "Why don't you join me for dinner on Dauntless?" He still hesitated slightly when calling his new ship by its name. "My shuttle leaves in a little over an hour." Baron paused, then added, "You can tell me of the fighting with the Krillians." Baron already knew most of what had transpired over the last 18 months, but he'd become quite adept at handling Palatians, and inviting one to recount the stories of a war in which he'd fought was the height of graciousness in their society. "I would be happy to tell you of our victories, Admiral." Baron held back a smile at the predictability of the Alliance officer, and he just nodded somberly. "I will see you in the shuttle bay in an hour then, Commander." He shook hands with the Palatian. It was predominantly a Confederation custom, but it was practiced to an extent in the Alliance as well. Baron turned and walked down the corridor. His gear had already been shipped up to Dauntless, but he had a few things left to do before he left Megara. As he walked down the hall, he found himself thinking about what Globus would tell him at dinner, about all the Palatians had done since the fighting with the Union ended. According to Gary Holston's intelligence reports, the Alliance forces had utterly eradicated the remnants of the Krillian fleet, relentlessly chasing down and destroying every last vessel. The dishonorable nature of the initial Krillian attack called for retribution on its own, but the fact that Tarkus Venius had been killed in the ensuing combat escalated things immensely. Palatian honor had demanded the complete obliteration of the Krillian holdfast at any cost, and that was just what it had claimed. Krillis himself had already been killed, of course, but that hadn't sated the Palatians' rage. As soon as the ships that had been deployed to the bottleneck returned to the Alliance, they invaded Krillian space, assaulting every world. The Krillians tried to surrender, but their pleas fell on deaf ears as Alliance ships blasted the last of their ships to plasma, and Palatian ground forces landed on their planets, crushing any resistance and brutally seizing control. Baron suspected the newly conquered subjects would pay dearly for their former master's perfidy. The leaders likely faced execution. Most had probably been killed already. The common people faced an uncertain future, at best as plebs serving the Palatian war machine, but possibly worse, as virtual slaves, repaying the honored debt incurred by their former masters through their blood and sweat. Baron saw injustice in that, millions suffering for choices in which they'd had no part, though he also understood the Palatians' rage. It was a reminder just how different the Alliance was from the Confederation, the divergent philosophies that governed their own systems of ethics and morality, and the role the Palatians' past agonies had played in the forging of their hard and merciless culture. The armed forces of the two powers had begun to develop a kind of mutual respect, one forged in shared combat. But Baron knew the future of friendship and cooperation between Alliance and Confederation would be difficult in many ways. Carelessness and mismanagement could derail it entirely. "You're already deep with the program to aid the revolutionaries on Baru. The Senate will crucify you if they find out what you're doing there. Now you want to sponsor exploration crews, pirates by Confederation law, on the frontier?" Admiral Van Stryker sat in his palatial office. The vast room took up half the top floor of the skyscraper that housed naval headquarters on Megara. No luxury had been spared in its construction or decoration. And Stryker hated it. Every paneled, gilded, antique-filled centimeter. He longed for his office on Grimaldi, for the practicality of that great fortress, so much closer to the recent battle lines than the Confederation's capital planet was. Gary Holston didn't answer right away. He just looked thoughtfully across the desk at his friend. Finally, he said, "It's a risk, no doubt, Van, but what else can we do?" Holston paused, then added, "I mean, really, what other options do we have? We got lucky with the Pulsar, you know that as well as I do. Tyler Barron's the best damned officer we've got, but there were 100 ways he could have failed there. 1,000. Is that our strategy, to get lucky again next time? The White Fleet may stumble on something extraordinary out there, or it may find that once it clears the Badlands closer to the Confederation, there's nothing but blasted and destroyed worlds. There are still artifacts out there, 5 or 10 transits from the border where we found them before. Can we continue to ignore that and count only on the White Fleet to find what we need at the old Empire's core?" "I understand what you're saying, Gary, but the doves are strong in the Senate right now, and you've got to know more than a few of them resent you. You've managed to dance your way around a whole string of crises, but if you get caught trafficking illegally in Badlands tech, they'll try to use it to bring you down." "Everything you just said is absolutely correct, but how does it change anything? If the White Fleet finds anything, well, we'll have to deal with how to handle that when it happens. But in the meantime, if you don't think Sector 9, or whatever they're calling themselves these days, isn't out there on every border planet and every spacer's dive bar looking for any old tech they can get their hands on, you're crazy. There's no appetite in the Senate for picking fights with the Union right now. You know that. They won't see this as a counter to a real threat. They'll say you're looking to undermine the peace, that you're violating international law." Stryker paused. "And when this last force reduction bill passes and you know you won't be able to stop it forever, our Navy won't be in much better shape than theirs, especially not with the White Fleet gone." "Van, every report I've been able to get from inside the Union says the same thing. Gaston Villeneuve has not only survived, he's managed to seize absolute control. The entire Presidium is gone, most likely assassinated on his order. He's got all sorts of problems, economic collapse, open rebellion. But he's dealing with it. All of it. We can't underestimate him. 200 years of Union oligarchy and on the verge of total ruin, he somehow manages to come out on top. You know as well as I do, as soon as he's able to rebuild his military and his economy, he'll be back at us. Long term, they need to grab some of our productive worlds, or at least hammer down our economic advantage." Holston shook his head. "Do you want to lead your spacers against a Union that's managed to find another artifact like the Pulsar? It could happen, and if it does now, we're at peace. There will be no chance to strike while they analyze and replicate it. They'll bring it back to some hidden research facility, and every scientist they've got will be on it. We won't know a thing until they hurl a fleet at us, armed with a weapon we can't counter." Holston sighed loudly and shook his head. "Whatever risks there may be, I've got to take them. I'd rather take the chance on my political enemies defeating me, even locking me away in prison, than knowing I'd let Villeneuve gain the edge. And watching one day as Foudre Rouge haul those oh-so-principled senators out of the capital." Stryker sat still, silent for a few seconds. Then he nodded. "You're right, but I still don't like the risk." He hesitated again. "Be careful, my friend. Don't get too involved, not directly." Holston looked back at the Admiral. "The funds will be routed through so many intermediaries it will take one hell of a bloodhound to trace them back to me." He paused, his eyes flashing to the door, almost as if he was concerned someone would walk in and overhear the conversation. "And I found someone special to lead the effort, someone who knows the Badlands border better than anyone I'm aware of, and who's far less conspicuous than me. All I have to do now is convince her to do it." Chapter 4. Coast north of Sea Haven. Planet Tellurus. Elecron 3. Year 315 AC. The sun streamed into the gallery, through the row of glass doors and the transoms above. The soft late afternoon light danced over the black and white marble floor, the shadows of branches blowing in the breeze projected across the wall. It was an image most would have viewed as a glimpse of paradise. Sea Haven was an idyllic town. an enclave where many of the Confederation's wealthiest maintained homes. The highlands lying to the north, great rocky heights soaring above the azure sea, were extremely sought after, a stretch of magnificent natural beauty dotted with great estates and mansions. The villa was as immense as it was magnificent, the craftsmanship that had gone into its construction almost beyond compare. It was only a few years old, unlike most of the well-maintained but aging homes that dotted the coast. It had been built for an industrialist who'd grown vastly wealthy on military contracts, and then been indicted on fraud and war profiteering charges. Its former owner was still fighting the legal battle to preserve some fraction of his wealth and stay out of jail, but he'd been compelled to sell off his non-core assets, including the artfully crafted vacation estate. Andy LaFarge was wealthy now, richer than she'd ever imagined, even as she'd spent her life in pursuit of such prosperity. And she was liquid. She had no properties, no investments in company stock. She just had cash. Several billion credits in cash, almost all of it courtesy of the immense fortune Gary Holston had paid her for the stealth generator. The property's distress sale had promised to be a brilliant investment, as well as an almost unparalleled place to live. But she hadn't been the only one interested in a villa. She had, however, been the only one who could move immediately, and that had proven to be an unbeatable edge when dealing with a desperate seller. For as long as she could remember, she had dreamed of such prosperity, of experiencing the life she'd seen the industrial barons of her homeworld living. But even as she closed the purchase and began moving her meager possessions in, she felt strange. Sad, disappointed, disillusioned. She couldn't quite pinpoint what was bothering her, save to say that reaching her goal felt nothing like she'd imagined it would. She had padded around her immense house for the first few months, bought some furnishings, though far from enough to fill all the cavernous rooms, and tried to adapt to the quiet life of leisure she'd wanted so long to attain. Then Tyler Barron came. He'd been stuck at the front, serving with the fleet as the ceasefire between the Confederation and the Union gradually solidified into a permanent treaty. She'd sent him messages, told him where she'd settled, and hopefully he would come to see her. And he did just that, the instant he'd gotten leave. He had been there for almost 6 months, and she'd truly enjoyed their time together. They'd hiked and explored all along the rugged coastline. They'd sailed the pristine waters of the Azure Sea, and they'd sampled the best restaurants Sea Haven had to offer. And those nights with Barron lying next to her had seemed shorter and far less lonely than those of the first few months in her new home. But now, after what seemed like a brief and fleeting interlude, he was gone, back to the Navy she knew had first claim on him. She told herself she didn't care, that she always enjoyed his company, but she didn't need it. Andy LaFarge didn't need anyone. That was as close to a rigid personal mantra as she possessed. She tried to keep herself occupied, to embrace her new life of luxury. She decorated more of the house, though she ran out of drive long before she finished. She tried to live the life of those she'd envied for so long, but it just didn't work. She was restless, unsettled, bored, miserable. Then Gary Holston showed up. Holston's family had an estate not far from Andy's villa, an immense palace that befitted one of the Confederation's wealthiest dynasties. The house was almost incomparably large, 2 or 3 times the size of Andy's palatial property, and the grounds consisted of over 1,000 hectares of prime waterfront and woodland property. Holston told her he had just come to spend some time at the family estate, to rest a little after the rigors of the war. That made sense, superficially at least, but she hadn't believed it, not for a second. Her suspicions were confirmed when she asked around about the Holston place. As best she could determine from speaking to longtime residents, Gary Holston had been there exactly once before, when he was 8 years old. Still, she waited, sure he would tell her why he had come, what he wanted from her. Eventually. She was curious, intrigued, impatient. The whole thing felt like some sort of high-stakes test of wills, and she was determined not to ask his real purpose until he chose to tell her. She found herself feeling more alive than she had since Tyler left. She gave Holston a tour of her villa, and they had dinner twice, discussing nothing more than pleasantries. She'd have made time for the man who made her so wealthy, of course, but she genuinely enjoyed his company. It reminded her of past adventures, experiences she'd considered hard and burdensome at the time, but now remembered more fondly. Finally, a week after he arrived, he asked to discuss something important with her. She told him to come to the villa, and the two of them sat in the study. It was one of the rooms she'd furnished completely, and surprisingly tastefully for someone who'd risen from the direst poverty and made her fortune as a Borderlands adventurer and smuggler. "We've confirmed that Gaston Villeneuve has secured his hold on power in the Union," he said rather abruptly as soon as they had exchanged greetings. Andy just sat silently, her eyes locked on Holston's. She felt discomfort, if not outright fear, at the mention of the Sector 9 chief's name, but she did her best not to show it. "He has a share of problems to deal with before he will be a conventional threat again. There is no question about that. But..." The word hung in the air as Holston paused, just for an instant, seemingly trying to decide how to say what he'd come to say. "But you think he will try to recover as much old tech as possible, and sooner rather than later?" Andy didn't give Holston the chance to finish. Suddenly she understood completely why Holston had come. She knew more about the border areas and the Badlands than almost anyone in the Confederation. "Yes, that's exactly why I am here, Andy. You want to pick my brain about the Badlands? Or you want access to my old contacts?" Holston just looked at her for a moment. Then he said, "No, Andy, I want more than that. I know you've just gotten yourself set up here and you deserve every moment of your retirement for all you've done, but I need you. The Confederation needs you." "Forget working me, Gary, just tell me what you want." "I want to make you part of Confederation intelligence. I want you to go to the border, possibly into the Badlands. We have to get our own operation going out there now. We have to find whatever old tech we can before Villeneuve's people do. And we've got to root out the Sector 9 influence. We let them throw money around on our planets and snatch useful artifacts from under our noses. Not anymore." She looked back at him, and she realized she was shaking her head. She felt a flash of defiance, of anger, not at Holston himself, but at the government he'd come to ask her to serve. "When I did that on my own, the Confederation called me an outlaw. They hounded us incessantly." She paused. "I assume there hasn't been any recent change in treaty obligations recently, or Confederation law?" "No," Holston said softly. "This would be a secret operation, one financed entirely by Holston family funds. We'll provide anything you need, and we'll split the value of any artifacts you find, with you and with anyone you recruit." "Are you crazy?" She wasn't often surprised, but she hadn't expected what she just heard. "I had nothing to lose then, Gary. Most of the crews out there don't, and once we do, if we get lucky enough to get that big score, we retire." She was silent for a moment. "Do you understand the risks in what you're proposing? I could end up in prison, or worse, and you'd be risking your entire family fortune. If we get caught, if the scope of your involvement becomes public, the Senate will crucify you." "So don't get caught." It was a flippant-sounding answer to a deadly serious warning, but suddenly Andy realized Holston had thought his proposal through, including the dangers, and he was still there trying to recruit her. "It's that important? You know how close we came to disaster with the Pulsar, and I'm sure you remember the Planet Killer, too. What do you think would happen if the Union were able to find another artifact like those, especially now when we're at peace? They'd have all the time they needed to get it back to their space without interference, to study it, replicate it." She just sat silently, taking a deep breath. She still felt an impulse to resist. She understood the importance of what Holston was asking, but she'd done her part already. The mission to destroy the Pulsar would have been impossible without the stealth generator she'd found. She wasn't a naval officer like Tyler. She didn't know the Confederation anything. Certainly nothing more than she'd already given. Could she even go back to her old life, wandering seedy spaceport bars, trading for information that was, as often as not, pure fabrication? She remembered the constant caution, the fear that any meeting could turn into an ambush in an instant. Most of all, she realized that joining Holston did not mean going back to the past. Her crew were all wealthy now, too, their shares of the proceeds from the stealth generator enough to support them for the rest of their lives in obscene luxury. They were scattered across the Confederation, settled, retired. If she went back, she'd be going back alone. "No," she thought. "I can't do it. I'm just having trouble getting used to life here. Things will fall into place." But then she realized part of her wanted to go. The excitement, the purpose. They called to her. She looked around at the exquisite room she'd created and realized how much she missed her cramped cabin on Pegasus. She still had Pegasus. She hadn't been able to bear the idea of selling her beloved ship, and since she didn't need the money, she'd kept it. In fact, the old vessel had been upgraded from top to bottom, no expense spared. Her days in that small ship had been full of danger, of hardship. But there was a void in her life now. She was in paradise, living a life few could dream of. And she was unhappy. Her palace had begun to feel too much like a prison. And she felt an urge to help Holston. He'd been more than fair with her in the past, and she owed her prosperity to him, at least in large measure. He could have confiscated the stealth generator as illegal contraband. But he hadn't. He'd paid her for it, and a fair price, too. But was that debt, and her own restlessness, worth upending everything she'd worked so hard for? She turned toward Holston, intending to turn him down. But then she said, "I'll do it." She wasn't sure what made the words come out, but the instant they did, she felt a burst of excitement that had been gone for too long. She was going back to what she did best, back to the rough and tumble frontier, the place where she'd first arrived as a destitute teenager seeking her fortune. She was going home. Chapter 5. CFS Dauntless. Ventica System, bound for planet Daneth. Year 315 AC.
"I want to thank you for the invitation to dinner, Admiral Baron. This mission is a difficult one for a Palatian. I understand the advantage of picking through the rubble of a long-dead civilization, but it is hardly work for warriors such as ourselves."
Baron looked across the table at Commander Globus. The Alliance officer wasn't a bad sort, and Baron had come to genuinely like the man. But he carried his Palatian warrior culture a bit more obviously than Vian Tullis had. Baer knew Globus's tacit inclusion of him and his people in the comment about warriors was a show of respect. No Palatian would say something like that if he didn't mean it. Diplomacy, especially when based on false compliments and feigned respect, was not high on the Alliance's list of competencies, and while Baer knew there had been enough secrecy and backstabbing during the Civil War, generally a Palatian said what he thought. Their honesty could at times be a bit brutal to someone used to more refined exchanges. "A warrior faces danger, Commander. While we are unlikely to encounter enemies of the normal sort, I suspect we will encounter more than enough hazards to sate the warrior's need." Baron glanced around the table. This was the sixth dinner he'd held for his top officers aboard Dauntless, though he was still having trouble thinking of his massive new ship by that name, and the fleet hadn't even left Confederation space yet. It seemed to be going well, and he felt a bit of relief. The first few times he'd hosted both his Confederation people and the top Alliance officers, it had been a bit uncomfortable. The two sides had been allies in the closing stages of the Union War, but the two cultures had considerable differences, ones that seemed more pronounced with his own spacers no longer in their wartime frames of mind. He doubted anyone in the Confederation uniform felt sorrow for the loss of potential combat opportunities.
"Indeed, Admiral, very true."
Baron knew that Globus understood the strategic need to uncover old technology before the Union or another potential enemy gained an unbeatable edge, but Palatian culture looked down on such peaceful endeavors. The scientists and engineers in the Alliance were ranked substantially below military personnel and social status, and Baron understood that Globus and his people had to fight against the ingrained notion that the mission was somehow beneath them.
"Commander Globus, perhaps you could recount for us the conflict against the Krillians. Many of us served closely with Imperator Venius in the Civil War, and I, for one, would be very interested in more details on his last battle. He was a noble warrior. I will always consider him a comrade I was proud to stand beside in battle."
Baron watched as Atar Travis spoke. He'd served alongside her for almost 10 years now, and he thought of her as his best friend, even as the sister he'd never had. But she still surprised him from time to time with the tact and diplomacy she could produce when the mood hit her. A request of Globus might seem a bit obvious to him and to the other Confederation officers present, but she clearly learned what he had in fighting alongside the Alliance officers. At least as far as he'd been able to detect, Palatians never tired of telling stories of their battles.
"Of course, Captain Travis, we all mourn the loss of Imperator Venius, especially at the hands of the deceitful Krillians. But we can take solace that his death in battle was a heroic one, an epic sacrifice that will immortalize his name and his reign. Our fleet was outnumbered, but Venius ordered us forward anyway."
Baron sat with an attentive look on his face, but it was a facade.
He had heard the retelling of the battle before, several times, enough that he could probably tell it himself. Still, allowing Globus to continue on had its uses. The purpose of the dinner had been the same as the ones that had preceded it, to forge his Confederation and Alliance spacers into a single unified force. They'd fought together, of course, but the Palatians had been segregated as their own task force, and they'd only fought a single battle.